We moved here from Los Angeles in April of 81, and pretty much within a couple of days, we met a lot of people because we just went to the record stores in Georgetown. And, you know, that was sort of like where you would meet like-minded people, would be at the record store. Danny Ingram worked at that record store, the first one that that I remember. And we met John Falls right away. And I remember John Falls taking me on like one of the 30s buses up Wisconsin Avenue and taking me to Beecher Street for the first time to meet Alec. I don't think Ian was home at the time, but that was the first time we went to the Mackay house, which, you know, everybody called Beecher Street. So, you know, we just, it was such a small scene at the time that we just sort of made friends with everybody right away. And I think we were a bit of, you know, Cynthia and I, kind of curiosities because we were, you know, these young girls who had gone to shows in LA and seen, you know, the Circle Jerks and Black Flag and the Go-Go's and all these bands, you know, so that was a little unusual, but the scene here was still pretty small. So Beecher Street was a house that a lot of people would congregate at. It was a very welcoming house. Like, the parents liked having lots of kids over, and it was a place where you would just could just show up and walk in the door without even knocking. You just walk right in, and Mrs. Mackay and the parents were always very welcoming. So, but Ian, you know, even then at that time, I think back on him because one of my earliest encounters with him was pretty soon after we moved here, and I had actually run away from home. And this was really soon after we moved to DC, and we didn't know very many people, but my mom knew that I had been hanging out with Ian a little bit. And there was a time that I went to a club or a bar in Georgetown, back when it didn't matter how old you were, I guess, because I was really young. And John Stab was there, and John Stab said, you know, everybody's wondering where you are, and your mom's really worried about you. You know, Ian wants to talk to you. And it was actually just really because of Ian that I went home, because of the way he kind of handled me and talked to me and convinced me to come stay with him at Beecher Street for a few days. And then he brought me home to my mother. So even at that age, when he was probably only 17 or something, he was really a leader, because he got me to do something that, like, probably nobody else would have been able to. And he definitely had a sort of charisma and natural ability to corral me and get me to do the right thing. I mean, and not too long after that, like Minor Threat, we had this house. Minor Threat practiced in our basement, and other bands did too. The house we were living in at the time had just this strange lot that didn't have any neighbors right next to it. And it had this bad old cellar. It was a really old house. So it wasn't like a nice basement or anything, but it had low ceilings and I think a dirt floor. But because there were no immediate neighbors right next door, and my mom was at work all day, it was a place, and she didn't care. That's became a spot where people would practice.
So why weren't you in a band?
Yeah, I don't know. I think about that now. It just really didn't even dawn on me to try it. I don't remember thinking that I couldn't, you know, or anything. It wasn't an issue of feeling intimidated, or I, for some reason, didn't imagine it. It didn't cross my mind to do it. You know, even that I had some female friends like Jennifer Harima from Royal Trucks and Christina Martinez and Boss Hogg. Like, they were friends of mine in DC before they were playing music. Like, those were two of my closest friends. And we were just, you know, like teenagers hanging out and going to shows and stuff like that, and working at Olson's, like, you know, working at the record store. None of us were playing at the time, and obviously both of them went on right away pretty soon after that to play. And, you know, I worked at the record store a lot, and then I went to college. So for whatever reason, you know, I just went to GW, and then I went to Georgetown and lived in Russia and went and did other things. I mean, music was still important to me, but it didn't cross my mind to try to play myself.
And you went on a cross-country tour with Minor Threat when you were like 14. How did that come about?
You know, I think that partly my mom was very enamored by Ian's non-drinking stance. Cynthia and I have an older brother who's passed away recently, who had a big drinking and, you know, drug problem. And, you know, I feel like that also seemed like more of the culture that I was in, at least in LA. So when my mom, you know, met Ian, and of course also when Ian brought me home after I'd run away. You know, she really trusted him and respected him in a lot of ways. And so I mean, it is a little surprising in hindsight that she let me do this, but me and another friend, you know, we flew to Ohio and went on tour with Minor Threat and the Necros in this one summer. I think it was 82.
With your new record coming out, obviously, at some point you picked up a guitar. How and when did that happen?
I was married, and I have two children. I have two sons, and when they were really, really young, I had this idea that if I played like acoustics, like if I got a guitar, that I could somehow entertain them, or that this would be good for them if I could sing them songs. So it really came out of some idea about out of parenting. I'm not sure why I thought that was a good idea. So I got a pretty cheap guitar. There was a store near DuPont Circle that I went to, just south of the circle, up on the second floor. I don't remember what it's called, but I bought a pretty cheap guitar there, and took like a group acoustic class through Arlington County. I live in Arlington, and learned a little bit. And my kids they didn't care less, and that did not work at all. But then I kind of enjoyed playing, and so I started taking lessons with somebody, and I kind of started learning songs of bands that I liked or things like that. But it really, really was more just as a hobby.
And obviously you started writing lyrics. The first single from your album is about a relationship that sounds pretty brutal, yet you share it in a song.
Yeah, people have definitely commented on my making myself vulnerable in my songs. And I guess, honestly, I don't know what else. It's hard for me to imagine what else to sing about. I mean, for me, all of my songs so far have started from a lyrical line. Like, they haven't, it's not like I'm writing guitar parts or writing, you know, some sort of guitar hook and then writing the song from the guitar's perspective and then adding words to it. Each of my songs has come from an idea or from something that's happening in my life. In my case, a lot of it is related to relationships, which is definitely connected to the fact that I'm single. So I haven't really found a lot of other things that I've wanted to write about that have meant enough to me or that have made lyrics that seem like something I could get behind. I mean, there is one song that I've written that is not at all about me, that is written from someone else's perspective. But I think when something feels very real to me, you know, then I feel like it's more convincing, or it gives me the passion to want to talk about it.
As you know, when we were setting up this interview, I sent you an email and I asked if songwriting was a way for you to deal with any Me Too feelings that you might have. And you quickly responded, "I don't have any Me Too stories."
Well, you know, I have thought about that since you wrote that to me. And I've went on tour with some punk rock bands and when I was really young, or been out, you know, when I was young at clubs and shows. So I feel like I've put myself in a lot of positions where bad things could have happened to me, right? And so I feel quite lucky, really, that in a physical way, I've never been assaulted, and it's kind of surprising considering all the things that I've done. But on the other hand, it is true that emotional, you know, there is such a thing as emotional abuse, or, you know, unhealthy relationships, or, you know, mean people and things like that.
And yet, despite what the guy in your song 21 said, you wanted things to work out. Any insight into why you wanted to stay in that relationship?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated issue. It took me a while to extricate myself from that. I think that some people, at least, I'm not going to say everybody can, but people's notion of normal can be adjusted pretty quickly. So I think that's why people stay in abusive relationships or tolerate abusive situations, whether it's physical or emotional, because you start to think that that's normal, or, you know, you make excuses for somebody, or you think that you can rationalize it because there are other things about it that are good. I mean, I think that that happens a lot, that somebody can have all kinds of great things about their character and then have some other pretty serious flaws. And the two things can coexist in one person, right? I mean, just because someone can be great in a lot of ways, but they could also be an abuser, right? So that, I mean, that was part of what I was trying to convey, because, I mean, this person did say that to me, and that is awful. But I didn't want to write a song that was just like, oh, I dated this person who was a jerk. Because to me, that's a little bit like less nuanced than what I was trying to convey, which is that I did date this person who did say this pretty insane thing. And then even still kind of upsets me now to think that I tolerated that, or that I still kind of made excuses for that kind of statement and stayed with somebody like that. And so it's, I mean, I was trying to show that nuance, or just, to me, that makes it a little bit more interesting in terms of a story. I mean, it's also the truth, you know, but I was trying to show kind of both sides of something